From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, killing by text message. A judge convicts Michelle Carter of involuntary manslaughter.
She did not issue a simple additional instruction. Get out of the truck.
Also today, our week in review.
An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
Reaction to the shooting attack on a congressional baseball team. And the genius and mania of poet Robert Lowell.
When you have that kind of genius hit by that kind of fiery, disinhibiting, reckless aspect of this illness, I think it loosened his thinking.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Here are two of the questions that a Massachusetts judge had to consider before delivering a truly dramatic decision earlier today. Can a person be charged and found guilty of someone's death even if she wasn't with the victim when the victim died? And can she be found guilty of killing someone because she sent text messages urging him to commit suicide? Juvenile court judge Lawrence Moniz believes the answer is yes and convicted Michelle Carter of involuntary manslaughter for encouraging Conrad Roy III to kill himself in 2014.
This court, having reviewed the evidence and applied the law thereto, now finds you guilty on the indictment charging you with the involuntary manslaughter of the person Conrad Roy III.
Conrad Roy committed suicide, succumbing to carbon monoxide inside his truck after Michelle Carter encouraged him to get back in the truck. WBUR senior reporter David Boeri was at the courthouse in Taunton today. And David, a really dramatic decision. What can you tell us about the thinking behind the judge's ruling?
Anthony, it was dramatic. We have to explain up front, involuntary manslaughter is a catch-all phrase. Now, in order to win a conviction, the government has to prove, among other things, that the defendant actually was the cause of the death. So the judge started this by separating a time period. The first time period included all the texts. The second time period began after the last text was sent, and phone calls followed the text. The judge found that in the first part, considering all the text, the government had failed to prove that Michelle Carter actually caused the death. She was wanton and reckless, didn't cause the death. As for the second part of what ensued after the text messages ended, there were two phone calls between Carter and Conrad Roy. He was in a truck. The truck had carbon monoxide fumes. They were building up. And as the judge said, he broke the chain. Whether he was intending to commit suicide or not, he broke the chain, left the truck, and he was breathing oxygen, air. At this point, according to the judge, Carter realized he was outside the truck. She told him to go back into the truck. And he went back into the truck and to the carbon monoxide. She could hear the fumes. She could hear him. She could hear him coughing. She heard this, according to the judge. And this is the definition of involuntary manslaughter, wanton and reckless. And for that, she was convicted.
Mm. Now, David, I understand that the judge went back to, two old cases to find a precedent for this ruling?
Yeah, and this goes to the nature. See, we don't have involuntary manslaughter is not codified in law. There's no description. So he goes to case law. One of them goes back to 1816 in Northampton. A prisoner is sentenced to be hung the next day for murdering his father, and a cellmate in the jail talks him into hanging himself before the government hangs him. He does that, and the Commonwealth charged the cellmate, and the judge today, Judge Moniz, was made sure that everyone knew this is not precedent-setting in what he's doing here, but following law. And the second one, which goes to 1999 in the Worcester fire, the warehouse fire, created through the SJC, the state's highest court, through their interpretation, it emphasized that when someone commits or creates a risk that could probably result in harm, great harm, that person, the defendant, has an obligation to report, a duty to report. She, Michelle Carter, did not do that in the case of Worcester. They didn't notify the firefighters. So that's the principle of involuntary manslaughter.
So, David, very quickly, what are the implications, in your view, of this ruling?
So, first of all, we have in the statutes, we have nothing that criminalizes encouraging suicide. We also have nothing that states that people have an obligation, a duty to report harm being done. So already the ACLU has stepped into this and objected to the ruling today. It will clearly be appealed. There are some big issues. One of them in this case is whether or not Carter created the risk. We know that the two people in the warehouse in Worcester created the risk because they were at the center of the fire that consumed the building and killed the firefighters. Did she create the risk? That's a variation of this question. Did she make Conrad Roy commit suicide? The judge today in his ruling basically said, yes, she's the cause of death. That's going to be appealed, and I think there's going to be an energetic appeal.
Really, really interesting story. David, thank you so much for your reporting. That's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri in Taunton. Let's turn now to our Week in Review panel for their reactions to this decision. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti opinion page. Tom, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
And Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, welcoming you here for the first time. Welcome and thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
So let's start. Reactions to this really stunning decision by the judge in the Carter verdict. Tom, I'll start with you.
So I was really surprised. I thought that just on free speech grounds alone, sort of First Amendment grounds, that this was going to be a hard one to get a conviction in. I think the judge's theory about her actions creating a duty to act is kind of novel. And it's not clear to me, as you know, we heard from the reporting just now, that that duty to act really was created. But I think that's what he really holds it on. That normally, if you see someone walking off a cliff, for example, you don't have an obligation to go save that person. But one could imagine circumstances where you would have that obligation. And that's clearly what the judge is trying to create here and saying that because Michelle did not call the authorities when she knew that, in fact, the carbon monoxide was going into the truck, she becomes the cause of death there.
Well, she becomes the cause of death in the judge's view because she not only didn't call for help, but she also said at one point he hesitates and he's out of the truck and she says, get back in.
Get
the truck.
Get back in. Yeah. Right.
Michael Jonas, your response.
Well, I also was really surprised by it. But I think to this point about whether she was the actual cause of it, it's interesting that Conrad Roy had on several occasions attempted suicide. He was obviously, you know, deeply disturbed, not well. The same is true of Michelle Carter. But I think that what was interesting or what's interesting often about people suffering from depression or have attempted suicide is that, experts will say often they're really not looking to kill themselves. It's a cry for help. So, although I think the defense tried to say he had a strong inclination to kill himself, I think you could also argue that he really was calling out for help. And when he reached out to her instead of help, what he got was kind of a perverse version of assisted suicide. In other words, assisting someone who, unlike someone with a terminal illness, someone who may well really not have wanted to die, or at least I think that's sort of what the judge's thinking seemed to be.
Yeah. We heard David Boeri talk about the response from the ACLU of Massachusetts. I'm going to read just a part of that statement. Mr. Roy's death is a terrible tragedy, but it is not reason to stretch the boundaries of our criminal laws or abandon the protections of our Constitution. There is no law in Massachusetts making it a crime to encourage someone or even to persuade someone to commit suicide. So, Tom, we heard David saying this will surely be appealed. I guess that would be the grounds for the appeal. Right?
Well, in an appeal, the question becomes this new law that's being created, how far does it go? It's one view, I suppose, is that Michelle Carter's actions here may be just simply unique. Maybe this this interpretation of the law that the judge gave will only apply to her and really to no one else. But you could imagine it being taken further. So, for example, if someone commits suicide as a result of watching the Netflix show 13 Reasons Why, is Netflix now responsible for that because they, in effect, are advocating reasons to kill yourself?
Deep question. Yeah. What do you think, Michael Jonas? I mean, it does sort of bring us into this world of words that kill in a virtual world of text messaging. It's sort of mind-boggling.
Right. And I don't think I had, in my mind, taken it as far as Tom's Netflix thinking. But I was thinking even in the, you know, in the social media world where, you know, people are Snapchatting or sending out group texts, you know, would some kind of a text that just was blasted out to a large group that you know, suggested something and then one out of the 30 people who get it then act on it, you know, will that become sufficient grounds for charging somebody?
Yeah. Well, if I tell you to shoplift something and you do, am I responsible?
Yeah. Interesting. Well, it's a fascinating case, and obviously it goes without saying, and also a tragic story, the poor young man. Let's switch gears. I want to ask you both about the really shocking shooting at a congressional baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia on Wednesday, in which four people were injured, including Louisiana Congressman and the House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who remains in critical condition. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan on the floor of the House.
We are united. We are united in our shock. We are united in our anguish. An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
We know the shooter who died in the shootout with police had been a volunteer for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, obviously a very troubled man, the shooter. Michael Jonas, what's your reaction to this shooting on Wednesday? What did it make you think about?
Well, I mean, I hate to make the connection to the case we were just talking about because they're obviously quite different. But the analogy, it seems to me, is that the broader context is that we're talking about this incredible polarization and coarsening of our political debate, and which is certainly a fact of life today. But then the question is, I mean, do you draw a connection between that? Is that the cause of people like this shooter, this unhinged guy, kind of going loose with guns, and you know, Bernie Sanders was quick to, you know, issue all the requisite kind of statements and contrition about what had happened. But there was this, again, this sort of connection between speech and then the actions of somebody obviously far out at the fringe.
Yeah. Well, Tom, it's true. I mean, it's an interesting, I mean, it's such a toxic and divisive time in our sort of political moment here in this country. I mean, is this a sort of wake-up call about that?
So I was in Washington, D.C. at the time of the shooting, and I will tell you, people were really shaken by it.
Yeah.
And the first thing you saw was an outpouring of people saying, you know, geez, you know, we really have to come together. That's what Paul Ryan was saying, that one attack on one is attack on all of us. And I have to confess, I veer between cynicism and optimism on this. You know, the cynical part of me says, just like every other shooting that happens, people decry it, people say we need to change it, and nothing really does. On the other hand, you are seeing some members of Congress perhaps getting a little bit of a comeuppance here and saying, you know, maybe some of their language has been intemperate. Maybe rather than just vilifying someone and saying you hate someone and that they're an evil person because they disagree with you, maybe you can just disagree. And it would be nice. I'm probably more cynical on this one, but there is a piece of me that thinks maybe the climate changes a little bit because of this.
Governor Charlie Baker got a little emotional on Wednesday when he talked about the tradition of this congressional baseball game, which, by the way, was played last night in front of 22,000 people. I mean, that's something in and of itself, because I gathered that usually just a few thousand people show up. But
they're not very good.
They're not very good. But here's Charlie Baker talking about the tradition, the importance of the tradition of this congressional baseball game.
I would just say that, you know, that game in Washington is one of the few events in D.C. that creates good feeling between Republicans and Democrats and members of the House and members of the Senate.
So, by the way, the Democrats beat the Republicans 11-2, but then gave the trophy to Steve Scalise, or at least to his office, while he's recovering, we hope. But, Michael Jonas, speak to the point that Tom raised. Tom said he veers between being optimistic and cynical about whether this will sort of, you know, engender some kind of coming together. What do you think?
I mean, I also waver. I guess I tend to think that there'll be a calm before we return to the storm. I guess that's that's the best way to put it. I don't think that it's going to reset things in a long term way.
You know, we were reminded of the shooting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords outside a supermarket in Tucson 6 years ago, when there was a push for gun safety, when there was a push for members of Congress to come together, but no gun control legislation even got out of a subcommittee, and congressional approval dipped to record lows. So that would suggest that, I don't know, maybe more of the same ahead.
Right. I certainly don't think you're going to see any gun legislation.
Right.
Yeah,
come that out was of my this. Next question.
Yeah. No. In fact, I mean, this has just served to, I think, polarize that debate further, because there's been a pretty strong argument put forward by gun rights advocates that, more death, deaths were avoided, and more injuries by the presence of Capitol officers with guns, and that the only thing better would have been if there'd been more people with guns there.
Right. The argument that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun was sort of proved true that day, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. I want to talk about two big departures, impending departures from Boston. The CEO of Boston-based General Electric, Jeff Immelt, announced this week that he was stepping down after 16 years at the company. He spoke to employees on Monday.
16 years is a long time. To run this company, even though I love you all dearly, it's long enough. And change is good.
Change is good. He took over the company just 5 days before 9/11. He led GE through the financial crisis. He oversaw the sale of GE Capital, and he oversaw the move of GE headquarters to Boston. So given all these changes and what GE has been through, Tom Keene, what's his legacy? What's Immelt's legacy?
Let's see. When he came in 2001, the stock was at $60, and when he exited, it was at $32.
That's part of the legacy, then.
That's certainly a big legacy.
Yeah.
And I think that probably speaks to why he left.
Yeah.
I think, obviously, Bostonians are thrilled with the fact that he moved the headquarters here, and that gain is clearly Connecticut's loss. I think that what GE is looking for is a new leader who perhaps can start to bring the stock back to $60.
Right. Interesting. So, Michael Jonas, what do you see as Jeff Immelt's legacy here in Boston?
Well, I mean,
and for GE.
Yeah. I mean, I think here in Boston, and we are the hub of the universe, so of course we'll think about it in our own terms. So I think his legacy is, frankly, that he brought the company here. I mean, we really didn't get to know him well. I was trying to think if the right metaphor is that this was, sort of an arranged marriage between Boston and GE or something. And then suddenly at the altar, one of the parties, was subbed out, and we're now going to get John Flannery suddenly as the guy. The sort of the GE half of this marriage, but I don't know yet, what that'll mean. And the focus here has been, is this going to shift their focus? Are they not going to be as committed to Boston as they seemed under Jeff Immelt? And I would suspect they are. I mean, this is a big change, a big move that was made with a lot of, input from the company more broadly than just the CEO. And so I don't think it's going to be a big change for Boston.
Absolutely. I mean, I think worrying about this as being a CEO issue is to misunderstand how involved a board of a company would have been in a decision as consequential as moving its headquarters. That board was clearly involved and clearly signed off on it. And Jeff Immelt's departure had been planned for quite some time and was certainly under discussion. And I think the transition was under discussion during the move, maybe even before the move.
All right. So let's talk about another big departure. Harvard's first female president, Drew Faust, announced that she will step down a year from now. We learned that this week. In a letter to the community, she wrote, "It has been a privilege beyond words to work with you all to lead Harvard through change and through storm." She led Harvard through the Great Recession. Also, she led a capital campaign that has raised $8 billion to date. And in her 2017 commencement speech, she spoke about the Harvard student body today.
Once overwhelmingly white, male, Protestant, and upper class, Harvard College is now half female, majority minority, religiously pluralistic, with nearly 60% of students able to attend because of financial aid.
And here's Bill Lee, a senior fellow of the Harvard Corporation, Harvard's governing body, talking about Faust's central accomplishments.
I think the most important may be her efforts and success in integrating across university and opening up the university to a more diverse, more eclectic, frankly, more interesting student body than we might otherwise have had.
So, Michael Jonas, jump in and sort of assess Drew Faust's legacy here. And it seems like a lot of people are talking about this commitment to diversity at Harvard.
And I think she did bring that. I think that the broader picture, I think, you know, is that I think Drew Faust provided sort of steady but not overly colorful leadership. I don't think that she was a particularly huge figure on the scene here in Boston. I'm not sure what kind of a figure she cut, you know, nationally in higher ed circles. I think she certainly, you know, was steady and did a good job. I mean, it's a reflection of really what being the president of these huge universities now is, that we're talking about the fact that the endowment took a huge hit in the recession, and then counterbalancing that with the fact that she exceeded even the initial goals of that capital campaign, which I think were $6.5 billion to be $8 billion. So it tells you a lot about the enterprise of being, you know, the president of a huge research university today.
Right. All about raising big money. Tom?
I think take a look also at who she succeeded, who was Larry Summers. And, you know, Summers was—
not being colorful might have been what the doctor ordered, right?
Right. So Larry was definitely colorful, definitely, you know, an intellectual spark. I think so much so that a lot of people got too much aflame from it. What they looked for in Drew was exactly what they got, which is steadiness. And at the same time, and really to her credit, Harvard now more represents America than it ever did before.
Yeah.
And that's really important if what you really think of this institution as a sort of a training ground for America's leaders. Having said that, the really fascinating thing will be who's next. Do the Board of Overseers try to go and get another steady hand a la Faust, or do they try to go for maybe more intellectual firepower?
All right, we have about a minute left, so I'm going to ask you guys both to be really brief and go through our hubbubs, those brief stories that might not have trended on Twitter but caught our attention. Michael Jonas, let me start with you.
So my hubbub is for Marianne Aden, who is a graduating senior at the City on a Hill Charter School in Roxbury. She wrote a piece, or she delivered a speech recently at the school. We posted it on our website at Commonwealth Magazine. Marianne is one of 12 kids, six of whom were born in a Somali refugee camp.
Wow.
She ended up in this country. She's graduating from City on a Hill. She's heading to Bridgewater State University. We hear these stories a lot. We think that they are, nice, gauzy, positive takes, but we kind of can be a little jaundiced by them. I think they're inspiring, and we really ought to stop at each of these and really admire and take inspiration from them.
Great story. Tom Keene, can you do it in 10 seconds?
No. Not possible. But I'll quickly tell you, I was going to do a piece about how the AP is changing its style book for how we describe addiction. It sounds like it's very politically correct. Now we have to talk, instead of talking about addicts, we talk about people with addicts. But you know what? If talking about people with problems means that they're more likely to get medical treatment for those problems, I'm all for a little bit of political correctness.
All right. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, and Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thank you both. Have a great weekend.
Pleasure.
There's more ahead. This is Anthony Brooks. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In his latest effort to reverse the policies of former President Barack Obama, President Donald Trump traveled to Little Havana in Miami today and announced that he is restoring some travel and trade restrictions with Cuba. Trump will reimpose a prohibition on Americans traveling there and bar U.S. travelers and companies from doing business with companies controlled by the Cuban military.
The previous administrations easing of restrictions on travel and trade does not help the Cuban people. They only enrich the Cuban regime.
For Reaction Now, we're joined by Micho Spring. She's chair of global corporate practice and president of the New England region for the communications firm Weber Shandwick. And Micho, good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
And with us here in the studio is Harvard professor Jonathan Hansen. He's currently working on a biography about Fidel Castro and travels frequently to Cuba. Jonathan Hansen, good to have you in. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
So we just heard Donald Trump talking about canceling aspects of Obama's Cuba policy. Micho, let me start with you. What's your reaction? What did you hear?
This policy reversal just makes change harder in Cuba. You know, the Cuban government has not responded to pressure from the U.S. for 56 years, and no question that many of us wish that the Obama policy had brought about more change. But although the government hasn't changed, Cuban society is changing, and this will definitely slow that down. I mean, 40% of the Cuban workforce is now in the private sector, with many of them benefiting from the 500,000 Americans who visited Cuba last year and the many more who are visiting this year. Airbnb hosts reportedly earned $40 million by hosting many of these travelers in their home. That will now slow down considerably, and it'll just chill the slow progress that, albeit slow, was being made.
Jonathan Hansen, I'd love for you to chime in here. Tell me what you observed in Cuba in your recent trips and how you think this new reversal of policy will affect that.
Yeah, sure. First, let me say that I agree with Micho 100%. And I found this a very strong speech for a very particular audience, that is the audience of those Miami Cubans, Cuban-Americans in Miami. I was also struck by it, how Trump inevitably in his policy sort of returns to the past. In this case, international diplomacy is a series of U.S. orders. He says that we hold all the cards. At the same time, he talks about making a better deal, but usually deals are made reciprocally in collaboration with others, not as a set of orders. So I think this was a real throwback to, well, it's not a throwback for Trump, but it's a throwback to another era of U.S.-Cuban relations.
Yeah. What about the central argument here? And that is, the Trump administration says that Obama's policy toward Cuba didn't work because repression on the island increased. And by some measures, that can be backed up. According to the Cuban Commission for Human Rights and National Reconciliation, there has been more repression on the island. I'll start with you, Jonathan. Is that concern at all valid?
Well, I mean, first of all, what is the pace of change that we expect when we initiate new policies? When the United States initiates a policy, do we expect others to fall immediately in line? Change takes time. Cultural change takes time. Political changes take time. Micho alluded to changes happening in Cuba. There are Cubans who are benefiting from Obama's policies. There are Cubans who are benefiting from Clinton's policies, and the privatization is happening across the island. I've seen change in Cuba over the last 4 or 5 years, even before Obama began to do this. Civil society is slowly opening up, political society less so. But changes are happening in Cuba, and they'll go on.
Micho Spring, I want to ask you, Weber Shandwick received a license from the U.S. Treasury to open an office in Cuba. You've been advising clients about Cuba for many years. Does what Trump announced today change any of that?
Oh, it makes it so much more cumbersome. No question about it. Look, our best hope for Cuba is not necessarily to hope that the regime changes, but it's to empower a new generation of entrepreneurs. And we need to empower that generation to have a stake in the future of Cuba and bring about change from the inside. That's our best hope. And that's what slowed down. It's interesting because in his rhetoric, he's talking about really wanting to benefit the Cuban people. And that's exactly what Obama's policy did. We all wish that the government changed more. And the human rights violations have been terrible. But I think our best hope is really to empower that new generation, which is very much committed to changing their economic future. And all that income is coming from tourists from the U.S., which is now going to be slowed down considerably.
And Jonathan Hansen, not too long ago, Donald Trump was in the Middle East, and he did all he could do to avoid a conversation about human rights in countries like Saudi Arabia. Here he was in Cuba talking about, we're making this change to enforce human rights.
Right. I mean, obviously the irony of that is speaks for itself. I can't add a lot more to that. I just want to speak a second to what Micho was talking about, the Cuban people. It's very interesting that that Trump evokes the Cuban people in this speech so much, but the Cuban people are almost wholeheartedly in favor of President Obama's changes. I've been to Cuba in the last 5 years, roughly 18 to 20 times, and I met one or two people opposed to the rapprochement that Obama initiated. So, I'm with Micho. I think if we want to open Cuba up, if we want to promote civil society, entrepreneurship, it's the more people we send down there, the more Americans, Cubans meet, and the more Cuban and American interactions we have, the better.
Mm. Yeah, and just the headline today is going to send chills, you know, on a whole cohort of people who are eager to go experience Cuba, right? I mean, it's just going to make it that much harder.
Now, can I just add one other thing?
Yes, please do.
You know, I think that this is in balance bad for Cubans. I also think it's in balance bad for the United States. I know that there are many in the Trump administration that were opposed to this, in the National Security and Intelligence Agencies, for example. At risk here, if Cuba starts to clam up, are the kinds of cooperation we've had between the national security agencies, drug interdiction projects, the Coast Guard, many, many other kinds of cooperation that have happened before Obama's initiative, but are continuing today.
Micho, I also think that we've got to take into account that there is a transition coming. I mean, Raul Castro has explicitly said he's stepping down in 2018. And the more civil society that we can help build before that, the better that transition will be for people who are hoping for a free Cuba.
Micho, we just have a few seconds left, but I just want to ask you one more question. You were born in Cuba. You fled when you were 10 years old with your family. You traveled to Havana with President Obama last year. I remember talking to you on this program about that. How are you feeling today?
Oh, so disheartened. I mean, Obama said when he opened that speech that he was there to bury the last remnant of the Cold War, and it's just reared its head again today. It's just going backwards, and it's very, very discouraging. My only hope is that the forces that have been unleashed and the hope that has been planted in Cuba in this whole new generation will continue, because the desire by that generation for a better economic future is so strong.
Well, Micho Spring heads the New England region for the firm Weber Shandwick and chairs the firm's global corporate practice. Micho Spring, always good to have you.
Thank you.
And Jonathan,
nice to be with you.
And Jonathan Hansen, professor at Harvard University, his forthcoming biography of Fidel Castro is called Young Castro. Jonathan Hansen, wonderful to have you too.
Thanks very much.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Robert Lowell died in 1977 at the age of 60. He was a towering figure, physically big, but most significantly dominant in the world of letters. A two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, Lowell was America's most famous post-war poet. Born in Boston, many of his poems made reference to his deep New England roots. Here's Robert Lowell reading the opening lines of his poem, For the Union Dead.
The old South Boston Aquarium stands in a Sahara of snow now. Its broken windows are boarded. The bronze weather vane cod has lost half its scales. The airy tanks are dry.
Robert Lowell's poetry was wide-ranging. It dealt with the personal and the epic. It spoke of friendship and death, Boston and Maine, as well as the American Revolution and the Greek myths. And he wrote it all while suffering from extreme bipolar disorder. Kay Redfield Jameson has written a new biography of Lowell that explores the relationship between Lowell's art and his illness.
I think he's extraordinary, and I wanted to do some justice to him, I suppose, in that sense. Lowell handled a great deal of adversity, a great deal of suffering, and terror, I think, of going mad always. And he did it with a remarkable amount of courage. And no matter what happened to him, he remained courageous in the light of a great deal of darkness.
Kay Redfield Jameson knows this subject well. She's a professor of psychiatry and mood disorders at Johns Hopkins University. She also suffers from bipolar disorder herself and has written and lectured about it extensively. She'll talk about it tomorrow at the Nantucket Book Festival and about her new biography, which is called Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire, a study of genius, mania, and character, in which Jameson explores that link between Lowell's mania and his poetic creativity.
When you have that kind of genius hit by that kind of fiery, disinhibiting, energizing, reckless aspect of this illness, I think it loosened his thinking. One of the things I tried to write about is that mania hit this incredibly fertile man who lived in history, thought in metaphor, being swept over by a force that rearranges and changes and speeds up and causes to, you know, I think really vault over the usual rules of grammar.
Mm. That's a great description. I want to ask you about the subtitle of your book, Setting the River on Fire, which comes from a poem, a Robert Lowell poem called Reading Myself. And we actually have a recording of him reading it. So I want to play just the beginning of it where he makes reference to setting the river on fire.
Like thousands, I took just pride and more than just, struck matches that brought my blood to a boil. I memorized the tricks to set the river on fire. Somehow never wrote something to go back to.
That's such a powerful poem that seems to really speak to this relationship between his illness and his poetry.
Yes, and I think also to his life in the sense that he, one of the things that's most striking, his daughter was kind enough to give me access to try and track down his medical and psychiatric records. And what is clear time and time again is his terror of becoming manic again, which is true for anyone who's been manic, but particularly if you've been manic as often as Lowell was. And I think that setting fire was not a metaphor. These were things that were very real to him, and he continued to take chances in his poetry, and he continued to face down what I think in most people would be just insurmountable demons.
But that line in that poem where he says he struck matches that brought my blood to boil, what's he say? I mean, he's aware of the power of his mania within his poetry, isn't he?
He certainly is. And he said to his doctors, he had the least romantic notion of it. It was devastating to him. It was costly. When he was finally given lithium and it worked, he was eternally grateful for that. But he also said to his doctors, you know, if I could keep the mania under control and keep that fire, I would do.
Interesting.
You know, I would use it for my art.
I want to hear a little more of Robert Lowell's voice. Here he is reading Skunk Hour. This is from his collection of poems called Life Studies.
One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down. They lay together hull to hull where the graveyard shelves on the town. My mind's not right. A car radio bleats, love. Oh, careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell. Nobody's here.
So in that poem, we hear him say, my mind's not right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, he wrote Life Studies when he was pretty much on the verge of being hospitalized for a psychotic breakdown, right?
Certainly he wrote a lot of it in the 3, 4, or 5 months leading up to a series of hospitalizations. He was hospitalized 3 times in a row. He wrote really fast and with great passion. And he felt, and I think many people would agree, he did his best writing that he ever did.
When he was manic?
When he was beginning to get manic. And then when he went over the cusp is when he ended up in the hospital. And indeed, even in the hospital, he finally ended up at McLean in Boston, and at that time wrote a poem that became Waking in the Blue, a great poem about madness and uncertainty and the leveling, social and privileged leveling effects of madness.
Crows maunder on the petrified fairway, absence, My heart grows tense as though a harpoon was sparring for the kill. This is the house for the mentally ill.
Wow, it's fascinating. You made the point of how difficult these manic episodes were for Lowell to deal with after the fact, because he'd remember everything about them, what he did, how he hurt people. And what would he do when he was manic that was so difficult for the people around him to deal with and for him to come to terms with after the fact?
Well, he did what people have been described as doing for 3,000 years. He did awful things. He was physically violent from time to time. He was cutting in his words, which in some ways were probably the most lasting effects on many of his friends, that he said things that were witheringly painful, caustic. Mm. And that's what people do when they're manic. You know, I mean, one of the things I try and deal with in the book is, you know, how do you deal with the fact that somebody who, by everyone's account, who knew Lowell, was a gentleman, soft-spoken, kind, generous, kind to his friends, to his students. And when he became manic, he was absolutely the opposite, as Jekyll and Hyde, completely. And how do you get around that? How do you understand that? He didn't ask for this illness. On the other hand, people who were exposed to it didn't ask to have that kind of unkindness either. So it was terrible things. He was unfaithful. One of the first signs of Lowell getting manic was that he would become involved sexually, romantically, with usually a young woman, and declare to the world that he was going to divorce his wife and marry this person. And then when he came down off the mania and became depressed, that all stopped and he went back to his marriage. But he did everything he could do to express remorse and to continue to live and face the next day.
You trace the origin of his illness back to his childhood. What did you find? I mean, what did a very young Robert Lowell, what was he dealing with? What did he know about his illness?
We know that bipolar illness is a hugely genetic illness. And so one of the things I did in the book was trace back several hundred years of mania and depression in the Lowell and Winslow and Spence and Trail family lines. As a child, he had this predisposition to volatility, to irrationality. And he was, you know, as his mother put it, who was less than a warm, cuddly soul. He was a difficult child. But he was also a deeply serious child. And he could stand back from who he was and see how difficult he was. At the time that Lowell was finally diagnosed, when he was in his late 20s, he actually got good medical care, such as it was. You know, the lithium wasn't available and the modern medications weren't available, but it was the same diagnosis that he got then that he carried for the rest of his life. Mm.
And as you said, he was eventually treated with lithium, which is often prescribed for people who suffer from bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And it helped him, but did it help him for the long term? What was his experience with the treatment?
He felt that it had made his life possible, that his health and his ability to stay sane was that he hadn't known before. So he was very grateful to it. At some point, he started taking, I think he started feeling a bit manic, at least this is what his psychiatrist described. He started feeling manic and he took way, way too much lithium. It's not an uncommon thing for patients to do, which is if you feel a bit manic to start piling it on. Unfortunately, with lithium, it's a very dangerous thing to do, or it can be dangerous. And he got very, very sick and ended up in the hospital and delirious and toxic. He never quite got sorted out on his lithium level after that.
I've been close to people who suffer from bipolar disorder, and I saw the lithium work. I saw it prevent the mania. But in so doing it, I also saw mania, lithium, depression, deep depression, drop the lithium to try to get back to that good sort of pre-manic feeling, and then shoot past it and back up into mania. That's pretty common for people who suffer. Or how common is that for people who suffer from bipolar disorder?
Well, it's interesting. I think it depends to some extent on when you were first prescribed lithium. Hmm. I was prescribed lithium pretty early on, several years after Lowell was, but still reasonably early on in the treatment of. As a result, I was kept at very high levels. And there's no question that there was a certain deadening, inability to think as quickly or intensely as I had done. But one of the things that happens is actually quite wonderful about medicine and science is that people learn and medicine changes. And people are kept now, and I'm kept now, at a much lower level. And I don't feel any of the side effects that I used to feel, and none of the deadening. So
I'm so happy to hear that. That's amazing news about lithium, to me anyway. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, and one of the things that we know about lithium is that it is, you know, it's variable. This isn't a variable illness. And one of the things about Lowell is that he could express his emotions and his thinking so incredibly well in his prose and his poetry. And he could kind of describe what would happen to him when he got manic and then when he was well and when he was depressed. And I've used Lowell's work for many, many years in teaching residents at Johns Hopkins about mania and depression.
Well, as you made reference to, you suffered from a bipolar disorder, and you write so powerfully about the mania. You talk about that mania can fire ambition, steal the nerve, and give high wind to imagination. You know, can you talk a little bit about your own, how you've experienced this link between intellectual energy, creativity, and this illness?
Mania is an addictive state. It's hugely powerful, and in maybe half of people who get manic, hugely enjoyable on the way up for a while before it becomes a total nightmare. In those early phases, you know, for a lot of people, your ideas come much more quickly. You feel the importance of the ideas, whether they're important ideas or not or something else again, but you feel the importance of the idea. You want to share the idea. You want to convey it. You want to communicate it. So one of the things that you find very commonly is that patients will give you, you know, reams and reams of written material and underlined in different colors and with a sense of time urgency as well as fecundity. But the next mountain over, you find that actually this is not quite the brilliant thing you thought it was. It's sort of like all the albums you buy after hearing music when you have smoked some marijuana, you know, maybe that is, right. You know, that those albums don't sound quite so great in the cold light of day.
Right.
And so that's true with one's ideas, but it's also true that some of those ideas you can rope in and develop and do something with.
Interesting.
And it's mainly, it's an intoxicating state. It's a reckless state, as in the excerpt that you have from Lowell about setting the river on fire. It is a reckless state. It is bringing your blood to a boil. It's going along with this incredible ignition.
Final question about Robert Lowell. He was a prodigiously productive poet. He's remembered as one of America's leading men of letters, despite his mental illness. Is it fair to say maybe even because of his illness?
I think one of the reasons I subtitled my book that it was a study of not only genius and mania, but also of character, is that it's what one does with it. I mean, everyone who knew Lowell thought he was a genius, and uniquely so. These were people who did not give out that title easily. He had an incredibly three-dimensional chess-playing mind and a remarkable poetry. I mean, I think his poetry is staggeringly original. And just it came across the American scene in literature and just transformed it. It really made a huge difference. And I don't think you see that very often. And I think one of the many wonderful things about Lowell is that combination of genius and how he took the disease that brought him to his knees and used it, but then brought this enormous will and willpower and discipline and courage to both writing and living. And to me, I don't know anyone like it. And I've been fortunate since I was 17 to have him in my life as an exemplar. And, you know, I think we don't have enough exemplars in this day and age.
Well, Kay Redfield Jamison, thank you for this. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you.
That's Kay Redfield Jamison. She's author of Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire, a study of genius, mania, and character. And she'll be speaking at the Nantucket Book Festival tomorrow. You can find more information about that at radioboston.org. Kay Redfield Jamison, thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again on Monday. This is Radio Boston.